Greeting and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm Gerald Harris, Chair of the Club's Science and Technology Member-Led Forum and your host for today. We welcome our listening audience and we invite everyone to visit us at commonwealthclub.org. Now it is my pleasure to introduce our speaker, Dan Sugar, CEO of Next Tracker. Mr. Sugar spent 25 years advancing renewable energy. As founder and CEO, Mr. Sugar has served Nextracker from inception to one of the fastest-growing clean technology companies in the world. As CEO of Solara Corporation, Mr. Sugar led the company through a 5X annual revenue growth over a three-year period. During his leadership as president of SunPower Corporation and president of PowerLight, he oversaw revenue growth from less than $1 million to over $830 million and was responsible for the completion of more than 500 projects serving commercial, industrial, and utility clients worldwide. Mr. Sugar has invented various PV systems applications, holds multiple U.S. patents, and has published over 50 technical papers. Mr. Sugar holds a BS in electrical engineering from Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute and an MBA from Golden Gate University. Please join me in welcoming Dan Sugar.
Thank you, Gerald. It's a tremendous honor to be here. And Gerald and I are both alumni of Pacific Gas and Electric Corporation, a great company where we used to work in the 80s. Well, the subject of today's presentation is called The Future of Solar Power. I heard someone say once, if you want to know where you're going, you have to know where you came from. So I'm actually going to spend a bit of time speaking about not only the background of the solar power industry, but the background of the utility industry and some of the fundamental structural setup for the industry and the compensation that are driving how the behavior of utilities today and how the solar industry relates to that, because it's part of the power sector and power industry. The utility industry really started with Thomas Edison at the Pearl Street Station in actually 1882. The first central station to generate power was a 175-horsepower steam-powered generator, and they were essentially running power lines down the street in New York City, and people were running a couple hundred lights off those. So that was the very first utility plant, and people were, you know, enthralled by the ability to have electric light instead of burning kerosene. A number of these type of power stations started to take off. In fact, at one point, there were competing companies that were running different power lines down the same street because they were vertically integrated utilities putting in power stations, their own wires, and selling the power to consumers. It didn't take long until cooler minds prevailed and said, well, this is kind of crazy with multiple lines down the street. We really need to just have one set of lines, but then that's monopoly, so we need to regulate it. Essentially, that was the birth of the regulated utilities. One company would have a monopoly on generating power, distributing power, and selling power to customers, and then they would be able to sell that. But how would you determine the rate? Well, public utility commissions were created to set the rates on those powers, and then the utilities were able to get a reasonable authorized rate of return. What was that rate of return based on? It was based on the amount of money actually invested. So there was an incentive to actually invest more and build out the systems. What happened after that was what I call the grand build-out period of the power sector and utility sector. I'll sort of abbreviate that and oversimplify it, but some of the basic concepts were that over the next 80 years, there was an incredible build-out in the power sector that happened throughout the United States and the rest of the world. This was driven by customers being able to use initially lighting and then in the industrial format, motors. So electric motors became prevalent. And instead of people building textile mills and other companies near rivers to use water power to turn, you know, machines with pulleys and so forth, they were actually able to use electricity. So it completely revolutionized the industrial sector. And then in residential, not only was there lighting, but then refrigeration, which revolutionized the food industry, and then air conditioning, which folks liked if you grew up in a hot, humid place and so forth. And so over this 80 years, what happened was there was a huge reduction in the cost of service from electricity. And so there was this fantastic cost reduction that happened over that time, an economy of scales. Edison and then others, Westinghouse, were building larger and larger steam generation, power generation devices. It transitioned from internal combustion and other types of forms, steam engines, to Rankine cycle steam power plants, which are essentially are an external combustion device. So as these things got bigger, costs dropped like a rock. And no one really cared very much because people had this great luxury of different appliances coming in, dropping costs. Just a very extreme build-out happened over this period. Initially, the first systems that Edison put in were actually DC-powered, but then they converted to AC. Westinghouse won that argument because a transformer is a very easy way to change the voltage of electricity, and high voltage is good because you need smaller wires to transmit, and you have less losses over a long period. So this grand build-out happened through the 60s, and everyone was pretty happy about it because costs were dropping. Consumers had a lot of choice, or not choice, but were able to affordably start bringing new appliances in. Well, things then changed in the 60s. There was this inflection point. What happened was these power plants that were getting bigger and bigger and benefiting from this huge economy of scale started hitting material limits. You couldn't build these Rankine cycle power plants bigger. They got to, you know, 500 megawatts or 1,000 megawatts and started to top out on just basic material limits. And there were a number of environmental factors that started to come in, and also the birth of the environmental movement came in. We had, up until that point, people thinking, wow, you know, this is great. We've invented, you know, atomic power, nuclear power. It's going to be too cheap to meter was an expression out there. There was a plan to build dozens of nuclear plants in California. Seven plants ultimately got built. Only one today is still operating, Diablo Canyon. Now, when I joined PG&E in 1986, there was this thing called AFUDC. It was accumulated funds used during construction. I'm like, what is this all about? Half of PG&E's net earnings at that point were going to pay for the interest on this nuclear plant, which was built because it was so over budget, which was happening. So all of a sudden, nuclear got really expensive, and these cost overruns were happening. There started to become a lot of issues. We had Three Mile Island happen, which melted down. And a lot of the environmentalists came in. We had Earth Day start. Rachel Carlson had the book Silent Spring. And a lot of folks were really focused on the dangers of nuclear power. In the audience today, it's my pleasure to point out Tom Van Dyke, one of the early protesters of nuclear power back east. And many of these plants just started to have a lot of issues, not only with nuclear, but other issues. So costs started to go up a lot. Then we had the Arab oil embargo in the mid-70s, and think people really started to focus on energy. In the United States, in the early 70s, about $2 billion was exported to pay for oil. By the time Carter was in office, almost $50 billion was going out to pay for oil. So this was like rapidly accelerating. So we had the Arab oil embargo. All of a sudden, people were thinking about energy. People were thinking about the environment. Costs were going up. Things started to change. Well, Carter then launched the Solar Energy Research Institution, SERI, which today is in Colorado. Today it's called NREL, the National Renewable Energy Institution. One of the first leaders of that was Dennis Hayes, a good friend of ours who actually founded Earth Day. They came in with an aggressive program to commercialize solar power. At that point, solar was really at a very low production level and was extremely expensive. But Some very smart people were focused on this. Initially, the folks that were really working on it were the Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena and other, in particular on the scientific side, folks working on space applications. This is where it was extremely cost effective. It's hard to change a battery up in a satellite, right? Very expensive. It cost actually at that time $20,000 a pound to lift a pound of anything into space. So if you had a solar cell up there, which was generating power, renewably focusing that on that, that was a good thing. Well, Bell Labs actually invented the solar cell, the commercial solar cell in 1954, but actually the photovoltaic phenomenon's been around a while. In fact, Albert Einstein actually won the Nobel Prize in 1921 for a paper he had written about a decade and a half earlier for the discovery of the law of the photovoltaic effect, for a paper he wrote regarding light energy and discrete quantum packages. So this was known, how this worked theoretically, but it was actually commercialized in the mid-50s by Bell Labs. Well, what happened is under the Carter, so there was a bunch of research that was happening to evolve these solar cells. Papers were being written. But what happened was there were these very early cost-effective applications. So we talked about the space application. There were also cost-effective applications on Earth. Remote water pumping. So even if solar costs in those days the equivalent of $50 a watt today, it was still cost-effective to have a panel that pumped water for your livestock if it was 5 miles to the nearest power line. So there was cost-effective water pumping applications. Telecommunications applications here on Earth were also cost-effective. If you had very far from the power line, you know, someone needed a repeater or something on a mountaintop. And then remote habitation started coming in the later 70s and 80s. People had a cabin somewhere, they wanted, you know, some power, and it was very far from a power line. So these applications grew. What was happening is people were commercializing solar. The size of the solar cells started to increase from like 2 inches to 3 inches to 4 inches to 5 inches, the size. And as that happened, costs were coming down. Solar started riding the sort of curve that was happening with semiconductor. So a basic silicon wafer, which is used to make a silicon chip, that basic wafer, if made into a standard semiconductor device, a PN junction, is actually a solar cell. So you had, with the space program, a lot of investment in semiconductor devices. The transistor was invented for the space program. And then to make a lot of transistors, you needed large silicon wafers. And so the space program was helping semiconductor, but then in parallel helping solar. So these technologies were growing together. So this was sort of going on. And in 1984, 1985, Arcosolar. And by the way, oil companies have had a love-hate relationship with solar. So at one point, they're focused oil companies, then they're energy companies, and they diversify, get into solar, and then they go back. And there's sort of a pendulum that's happened with a lot of the big oil companies. But ARCO went big into solar in the mid-80s. They built the first multi-megawatt power plants that were built in the world. Actually, the first plant over 5 megawatts was built in San Luis Obispo, Bow County, up at the Carrizo Plain, and that power was sold under a long-term contract to PG&E. I had the opportunity to visit that plant when it was operating in the late 80s when I worked at PG&E, and we went up and characterized that plant. Actually, I'll fast forward a little bit. When I was at SunPower, we developed one of the largest projects in the world, a 310-megawatt project at that exact location where that plant was, that original 6-megawatt plant. But I remember driving out there the first time, looking at it in 1988, thinking, wow, that thing is huge, you know, and 6-megawatt plant. And we came back and did a 310-megawatt plant, which is operating today, a SunPower plant. So all this was sort of happening. There was progress happening. And then Reagan got elected. And one of the first things he did was he tore the solar hot water panels off the White House that Jimmy Carter put up there sort of symbolically. There's sort of a theme here, which policy has a really big impact on the growth of technologies, in particular renewable energy technologies, as they come in. This is more or less when I entered the solar business. So I studied electrical engineering. I started at PG&E as a transmission planner. And then to my great luck, while just minding my own business, sitting at my desk, doing high voltage transmission planning, not far from here in San Francisco, I saw the opportunity to work in the R&D department, specifically in the solar power area. So I'm like, oh, photovoltaics, what is this? So I started like researching it. And I'm like, wait, let me get this straight. I've got this device, and the light energy hits this thing. It makes electricity. So I'm like, well, when does this silicon thing run out of electrons? It doesn't. What happens is basically, so if you take this device and you look at it with, you know, some incredible device, which we don't have today, is something better than a scanning electron microscope, you'd see these atoms, silicon atoms, and flying around those would be these electrons, which are kind of like, you can think of it like our solar system. So the the nucleus is like the sun, and these electrons are like the planets. These things are spinning around in what are called valence shells. What happens is when the light comes down, the ones that are far away from the center, when the light, the photons of light from the sun hit, they elevate the voltage. And then for a brief time, that electron's free. And if it can find a path in a closed circuit, its voltage is elevated, it's liberated from that orbit, providing there's another electron to fill its place. And so if you have a closed circuit, if you have a solar cell and it's connected through, let's say, a light bulb, it will make power, electricity, indefinitely. It never runs out of electricity. So I'm like looking at this, I'm going, this is amazing. You take this thing, you put it in the light, and let's say there's a little load, like a light on there. The thing will just make power forever until the packaging goes away, okay? So I was very intrigued by this. So I'm like, what? That's amazing. So this technology is the only technology to today that makes energy with no moving parts and burning no fuel. Nothing else does that. So I fell in love with this thing. So at that very moment, what I was doing in my career was I was doing transmission planning. And what you do in transmission planning is you're a utility guy. So you're trying to provide reliable service to customers, right? It's like, okay, I've got this big generator like Edison's thing, except way bigger at point A. And I've got these customers and I have power lines. There's a lot of losses in those lines, by the way. I used to run things called power flow studies for PG&E. At that time, I remember just in the high voltage system, there's 780 megawatts of loss. Just in the high voltage system, wow, that's a lot of power, 7% of the system at that PG&E system. There's a lot more losses in the distribution system as you go. So maybe in total 20 to 30%, pretty big numbers by the time it gets to customers' electric load. So we were planning to put new power lines in, but you're not really sure what's going to happen out at the end. Like, is that load going to continue to develop in that community? Are people going to keep putting houses in and stuff? Are new agricultural water pumps going to come online? You're not really sure what's going to happen 5 years, but you have to make the investment today and plan for that as a utility to provide service 5 years from now. So we were doing these. And by the way, the time you need the power tended to be in the summer afternoons for a very short amount of the year. So the line's good and the substation's good for 90% of the year, but maybe 10% of the year the system gets overloaded. And when is it overloaded? In the summer afternoons when people are using a lot of electricity. So I'm like, wow, we've got to make all this investment, and it's uncertain to provide power for a small amount of the year. And conveniently, that time when you need the power is perfectly coincident with sunlight. So I saw this photovoltaic technology, and I was like, this is amazing. So instead of putting a 100-megawatt plant in the middle of the desert, why don't we put a lot of 1-megawatt plants at the end of these power lines, and we can support the grid. And so at that time, PG&E had just started a program with the U.S. Department of Energy called the PVUSA Project, Photovoltaic for Utility Scale Application Project. It was in Davis, California, and its original purpose was to demonstrate new technology. And many of the technologies you see today in crystalline silicon concentrators and thin film photovoltaic devices were actually pioneered on that project. And so at this Davis site, we build these technologies and monitor how well they performed. So I got engaged with this project. I started working in San Ramon, had the privilege of managing PG&E's solar and distributed technology research group. And I was like, look, instead of doing this technology demonstration, let's do that, but let's also do an application demonstration. Let's put a plant, instead of just putting them all in this one place, let's find a place at the end of the line, the end of the electric power line, that's overloaded or will be overloaded, build one of these plants, and empirically measure the benefit this is providing the grid. And so we developed a methodology we called the double screen methodology. So basically it was like, okay, we're going to find a place. We had loads measured, meaning like a bunch of home, like how much power they're using over the course of a month, and commercial buildings in all different climate regions within PG&E. We had weather stations. And so we could map out, we could simulate a three-dimensional load curve in Stockton, for example, in July. And then because we had a weather station down there, we could simulate how well the PV did, and then we could line them up. So it was like, let's find places where solar is going to provide a local benefit to the grid, meaning when it's peaking, the solar is putting out a lot of power. And the second screen was, let's find a place where the grid's getting overloaded, where we may actually need to make an investment. So we did that, And we rolled out, and I remember I submitted this request to the mainframe, which we had at the time, and the billing people called us up, and they're like, what did you do? Like, that thing you just submitted is going to tie up our computer for like a day and a half. Anyway, so we finally got the computer time. It ran through PG&E's mainframe at that time, and out of there, we were able to determine, oh, here's all the good places to do it. And guess what? There was a huge prevalence between the match between which areas were getting overloaded and the solar availability. Like 60% of the areas, 60% of the planning areas had an excellent match between solar and the need for power in those areas. So then we looked at a few places that were going to have require investment. We selected one. We built the project, which was actually the largest photovoltaic project built in the Americas in the decade of the 90s, and it was 0.6 megawatts. Okay. So we built that project. It's called the Kerman Project. But as part of PVOSA, we measured it. And guess what? It worked. So we were able to turn that plant on and off, and we looked at what happened to the transformer in the substation, and it cooled the transformer. When we turned that plant on, it reduced the power. It reduced the heating of the transformer, which drives when you would need to replace. And transformer is a big, lumpy asset. It's almost the size of this room. At the time, $2 million, a lot of money back then. So you didn't want to make that investment unless you really needed to. It also provided voltage support on the line. It reduced the losses, electric losses in the line. It provided operational benefits, and we quantified that, published a lot of papers on all the benefits around that. So that's how I got into solar. We did a lot of other work in superconducting magnets and batteries and so forth, but let's really focus on solar today. We had a great run there at PG&E, and really we were the leader at that time in utility renewable power. So what happened is the utility industry started moving toward where the telecommunications industry did. So telecommunications used to be, you know, run by monopoly, got deregulated, cost dropped to consumers. So folks wanted to move the utility industry to a deregulated place. So PG&E and a bunch of other utilities said, wow, we've got to shed costs. We're going to just be a generation company. Let's divest this, you know, the R&D and all these other groups. And so I then was like, well, I'm not going back to doing transmission. I love the solar stuff. So I left and went in the photovoltaic industry. What happened is, before I left PG&E, the birth of net metering, I want to speak about that. Again, sitting at my desk, now I'm in solar, minding my own business, we get a phone call from, hi, I'm the branch manager for Robin Williams, the actor comedian who passed away a few years ago. And Mr. Williams has this beautiful ranch up in the North Bay, and he's an environmentalist, and he has a bunch of meters, and he just wants to put solar on his property and not pay like seven or eight bills. He just wants to put one big solar on the property and like net out his load. I'm like, listen to this. Like, that's a great idea. And PG&E is going to benefit because we're going to get all this really valuable peak juice in the middle of the day. And then we're going to sell him off peak stuff at night through his meters. And it's all good. He's going to do the right thing. Until we tried to get that through, I got in the screaming match with the law department at PG&E. It's like, well, you can't do that because God forbid one of those electrons could escape Mr. Williams' property and make its way over the border in Oregon or to Arizona, and then you're going to violate interstate commerce. And I was having this discussion with this attorney, and I'm like, with all due respect, you have no idea what you're talking about or how the electric system works. That juice is going to be consumed like on the property or in the immediate vicinity thereof. So that kind of bothered me that we couldn't get that done. So I left PG&E and then kind of went to the other side of the table for the industry and started working on net metering. A couple of colleagues of mine, a few of whom also worked at PG&E, notably Howard Wenger and Tom Starrs, who is a wonderful person, and Les Nelson, those guys did a lot of pro bono work. They actually authored the original net metering legislation. And I was engaged as lobbying for that and then also testifying for it, both at the California Energy Commission, but also the California Public Utilities Commission. And we were successful in getting net metering passed in California. And it's been replicated in almost every state in the country. The original sort of cap on it was, well, it's like, okay, we're going to let this through, but you're limited to 0.1%, because God forbid if more solar gets in, that would be bad. So we put the solar in. We blew through the 0.1%, eventually 0.5, then 1, then 5. Near the end of the year, net metering 2.0 was passed. It's unlimited now in the amount of net metering going in. So I'll never forget this. I was testifying on the stand of the Public Utilities Commission in 2001 as the expert witness for the industry, the solar industry. And I was on the stand under oath, cross-examined by utility lawyers for 3 hours. So I had PG&E, Edison, San Diego Gas and Electric, and someone else. They asked me, at that moment, there were only 2 megawatts of solar power connected in the all of California, grid connected. This is 2001. They said, well, what could, like, how much could be here in the next, like, 5 years? And I was like, 50 megawatts? Like, thinking, like, that would be, like, that's crazy, like 25 times more, right, than in the history. Okay, so my company right now, we're shipping 110 megawatts a week of solar trackers. Last year in the United States, there were 7,000 megawatts installed. And so when I was on the stand there in 2001, there were 2 megawatts cumulative done in California, right? So to just give you a sense of scale. Okay, so let's get to a little more recent history. So I ended up joining with this company, PowerLight, in 96, and our objective was to be number one large-scale solar company in the world. With my partner, Tom Dinwiddie, we started on rooftops. We did projects, for example, the Moscone Center is covered by solar panel. We did hundreds of projects like that. But eventually it was like, wow, like a lot of my customers need a lot more power. We need stuff on the ground. So we had done back at PG&E in the late 80s and early 90s trackers. And a tracker is basically a device that aims the panels at the sun in the morning, and then over the day it follows the sun as it goes toward the east, and you get about 20 to 30% more energy in a sunny place by following the sun than being stationary. And so a lot of our customers initially in Hawaii and other places needed more power, so we really started focusing on trackers at PowerLight. We essentially revolutionized that part of the industry because it was sub 1% of the industry prior to then. We really focused on it and built the world's first 10-megawatt project that was over in Germany in 2004, and then larger projects, eventually this 310-megawatt project I mentioned in the Carrizo Plain in San Luis Obispo, all on these trackers that are following the sun. We built this company out and then really drove down the cost of solar power because you're making more power, the costs are lower, and then we're also monitoring these systems through the internet, and we were able to achieve plant availabilities, meaning when the sun's shining, we were able to take the plant availabilities. Initially, they were in the mid-80s to over 99% of the time the sun was shining, these plants were making juice. Solar is by far, of any way to generate power today, the most reliable and available way to generate power, period. People say, well, what about when the sun's not shining? There's a lot more power consumed during daylight hours than there are at night. Okay, so during daylight hours, when the sun's out, these things are incredibly reliable. So we eventually merged that company. We were going to go public. SunPower ended up buying the company, and I served as president there for a couple years. It was an awesome run. Eventually, I took a sabbatical, spent time with my family. I was going to go back, but I ended up wanting to do another startup, and I got enamored with a new technology at a company called Solaria. We developed some amazing technology. We built the world's largest low-concentration photovoltaic plant. But we needed a tracker at that company. So the tracker industry had been fairly stagnant since we had commercialized this technology from PowerLight and SunPower. So we reimagined the tracker and created this company called NextTracker. We spun this out in a separate financing that I put together with initially closely held investors. And we built that company. We actually spun it out only in 2013. And so we started in 2013. We shipped about 5 megawatts in 2013. We shipped in 2014 45 megawatts. Last year we shipped about 260 megawatts. And now we're shipping 500 megawatts a month at this company today. 2,000 megawatts last year. This year we're currently at a run rate of over 100 megawatts a month. So it's over a 5-gigawatt run rate. Now, if you're not used to these megawatts, gigawatts, blah, 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 let me just boil this down. Okay, that is so much power. PG&E The total load of PG&E when I left was 20 gigawatts. That was the peak load, right? My company is doing 5-6 gigawatts a year, every year. So in 4 or 5 years, we do the peak load of PG&E, which is one of the top three utilities in the country. So a lot of power going out there. So the industry, so let's get to very recent times and we'll talk about the future. So what's happened in the last couple years has been just tectonic shifts in the market. If you went back 5 years ago, the market was dominated by Europe. Germany alone was doing over 80% of the global solar. They had a lot of incentives. Well, this financial crisis hit, people pulled back on the reins right when the financial crisis hit. And at the same time, the Chinese went hugely into manufacturing, starting about 7-8 years ago. Prices as a result of that dropped very significantly. So what happened was the market started shifting to markets where fundamentals were more important, like the amount of sunlight. Not a lot of sunlight in Germany. The meteorological equivalent in the U.S. is Nome, Alaska, of the best place in Germany, which is Bavaria. Okay, so what happened, Europe went from like 80% to 20% of the global market, and markets started to develop in the U.S. The market is very strong. Over 7,000 megawatts were installed, as I mentioned, in the U.S. last year. And today, the U.S. market's running at a clip of about a gigawatt a month, so about a 12-gigawatt clip. Now, to just contextualize that, there was more solar installed last year in the United States than natural gas or coal. I remember when the Bush-Cheney administration was in full throttle, Dick Cheney said, oh, you guys are less than 1%, and you always will be. And I love that he said that because it made all the hair on the back of my neck stand fully erect and basically said, like, we are going to just commercialize this technology and really make this thing the largest source of energy, period. And I believe that's where we're going. The other thing that happened is basically the Sierra Club started the Beyond Coal campaign almost 10 years ago. And the objective was to basically stop every single new coal plant from being installed in the United States. And they, by and large, succeeded. There were 220 plants that came out of the Cheney energy plan. Of those 220 plants, 200 were killed outright, those projects. The Sierra Club and their allies, and there's 100, literally, organizations participating in a coalition, environmental coalition. I had the privilege of serving on the board of the Sierra Club Foundation for 6 years. My term just ended. Very systematically modeled every single coal boiler in the United States and went after every single one whenever there's a change of state, meaning it's up for permit or renewal or what have you. And of the existing fleet, a third of the fleet's been announced for retirement by 2020, which is unbelievable. So if you went back 7 years ago, 55% of national energy was coming from coal. Today it's 30%. Now, some of that's been replaced by gas, but an equal share has been replaced by energy efficiency and renewables, and it's very exciting. Now, let's get like really current, look at what's going to happen, you know, as we go forward. Last year was a phenomenal year of environmental policy. We had a number of huge things. It started with the Pope. Okay, I've never been someone that's read any, you know, document written by the Pope. When the Pope came out with this environmental encyclical, it blew me away. I actually downloaded it. I breezed through it. I focused on the renewable sections. It specifically calls out, we must transition the world from fossil and polluting energy to clean energy. And this was a huge signal for the Pope to do that and equate environmental justice with, you know, taking action and doing the right thing for the climate and the planet. Then we had the Paris Accord. My son David Sugar was there. Tom Van Dyke was there. And we had all the countries come together and basically sign a document that said people were committing to transition to reduce the amount of carbon going in the atmosphere. Then closer to home, we had some other very major policy developments. First, we had an extension of the investment tax credits, which were due to expire at the end of this year, 2016. So there was a 30% investment tax credit. So if you spend $1 million on a solar for your building, you can essentially get a $300,000 deduction the first year, plus accelerated depreciation. There was an acceleration in the market to capitalize on those credits prior to their expiration. they were extended by 4 to 5 years, and then they trailed down at the end of the time, which was not something most of us in the solar industry were expecting. So that was a huge thing. And then in California, as I mentioned, we had the net metering extension. All these things combined, it was the best year in environmental policy ever. And so we kind of have a lot of nice things set. Okay, so what's going to happen going forward? So when I started in the industry in 1988, the global market was each year produced and installed was about 30 megawatts. Okay, last year was 65,000 megawatts, or let's say three times the peak load of all of California. That's how much solar power is made and installed on an annual basis. Where's the largest market? Unbelievably, China. So what happened was China was totally an export market up till about 5 years ago. And then there was sort of the air apocalypse, which is happening over there. I don't know if any of you have been there recently. I have multiple times. It's really bad. And it's most acute in Beijing, where a lot of the policy folks are located. It's so bad, literally this street, sometimes you cannot see across the building across the street. It's absolutely atrocious. There have been a lot of reports of, you know, how bad the air is, but that's resulted in policy. And so that market has become the largest market. It's like a 20,000 megawatt market, 20 gigawatt market. LA, 50 years ago in LA, we used to have horrible air quality. And through environmental policy, by focusing at that time on catalytic converters and point source emissions, we were able to clean up the air in LA. And in China, they're focused on doing the same thing. They know they must do that. And so both for solar and wind, it's become the largest market. We've seen other markets have developed, Latin America. We at Nextracker have put hundreds of megawatts on the ground in Chile. And so Chile is a source of very important raw materials and commodities like copper and many other raw materials. And there's a huge energy use there. And it's a very professional type of environment in which to do business. And so they've created policy there. So we've installed many systems there. But what's interesting is a year ago, there started to be projects that were financed on a pure merchant basis, meaning that you had projects financed in the hundreds of millions of dollars of a project with a $100 million budget or more that didn't have a firm offtake agreement in a long-term contract with the utility. Rather, they were financed just to sell power into the open market, and financiers believed that was going to be a solid income stream. So you started to see these type of projects develop. Even in Honduras, you don't think of Honduras as one of the most industrialized countries in the world, right? It's actually, its notoriety has the highest murder rate in the world per capita is in Honduras. We installed an 80-megawatt photovoltaic plant in Honduras last year. So places you wouldn't think. So places are cropping up. Uruguay, so a lot of Latin America. Over in Europe, you know, Germany's done their build-out. Spain, Italy have done their build-out. Turkey and places like that are taking off for solar. So we're seeing the growth happen. Now, what's going to happen on go forward? Well, the thing that I've consistently gotten wrong in my career is I've always underestimated the possible growth of this technology. And where it's happening now is unbelievable. Costs have come down by a factor 25x. So when I built the project for PG&E in 1993, the largest project built in the decade of the 90s, the Kerman project, it was about $10 a watt in those years' dollars. In today's dollars, call it $30 a watt for the whole plant. In 2007, we built the largest plant in the United States again, which was the Nellis project when I was at PowerLight and SunPower right at the transition, a 14-megawatt project. It was $102 million. Okay, in those years' dollars, that plant was $7.02 a watt. In today's dollars, call it $8.50 or $9 a watt. Today, plants are going in India for $1 a watt. And in the United States, they're going in for maybe $1.50. These are large ground-mounted systems. And residential rooftop systems are going in for $2.50 or $3. So because costs are at this unbelievably attractive place, it's going to fuel unbelievable growth in the market. We've crossed the demand elasticity place. So you're going to see ongoing cost reduction, ongoing technology progress. You're going to see thinner silicon wafers. You're going to see much more efficient cells. Cells are going from 14%, from 10% to 14% to 20%. You're going to see them going to 25% over the next few years. You're going to see integrated electronics Right now you have separate inverters. Eventually those are going to be in the back of the solar panels, and maybe even on the silicon cell itself. Well, each one will have an inverter, you know, 20 years from now. So we're going to see this technology continue to grow and be the largest form of energy, period, fueling the grid. That's where we're going to go. I have more to say, but I want to leave time for questions. Mr. Harris, thank you for the opportunity.
Great. All right. Please join me in expressing our appreciation for Dan Sugar. Okay. We would like to remind the listening audience this is a program of the Commonwealth Club of California. We are now open the floor for questions. Please keep your questions short. If you have a question, please stand up behind the mic and remember we are recording. So.
My name is Larry Risman, also once upon a time a PG&E. I have a question for you. Actually, it's twofold. One is about solar and storage. I know in Germany, the same subsidies that we have here for solar, for our investment credits, they have for solar and storage to go with it. Here, there's nothing like that. Is storage something which just is going to go along with the solar, or that's just sort of something that's going to fall away? And a completely different topic is,
yes,
you mentioned a lot of places where solar is coming in. What about in the developing world, places like Africa? There's a big Power Africa project under USAID that I happen to be working on in my company. And there are places where the grid's never going to, well, not never, in the foreseeable future isn't going to reach, and they're talking about solar and microgrids, but they're not, from what I hear, talking about utility-scale solar, where even if you're never going to have the grid reach from southern Ghana to the northern part of Ghana, you might put in a utility-scale solar someplace up there and serve the communities around it.
Great questions. Let's take the storage question first. So there's a prevailing wisdom that, like, well, hey, solar can't really go much further without storage. So first of all, I just want to sort of take, for the solar industry, take a quick victory lap here. So for us to have imagined 10 years ago, if you look at the California grid, there's 50 gigawatts, 50,000 megawatts, right? For us to seriously say we've impacted the peak grid or the peak load curve of the whole grid, which we have, I mean, that's phenomenal. I mean, really. But do we need storage? How much? So there's been a lot of progress in storage driven initially by electric vehicles. The technology of lithium-ion batteries has come hugely. I drove here in a 7 or 8 year old Tesla Roadster, which I bought. I ordered a new battery for that car. The battery in the same size literally doubled the range from 200 miles to almost about 350 miles. So that's how fast battery technology is evolving, and the costs are dropping. Today, 99% of the solar put in has zero storage. You can put storage in for backup, but you don't need it to work interactively with your home or business. I think storage will increasingly come in to renewable power, but I think storage is one of several ways we're going to manage. So let's say there were just even 3 or 4 times more solar in the grid, which will happen. It's happening, actually. There's this thing called the duck curve where people are envisioning a huge amount of solar, and then the load shape looks like a bit of a duck. We think that's going to happen in about 5 years, four to five years. Storage is one solution, but there's other solutions, very simple solutions. Load control. And I think the way you can manipulate the grid, now that you have Bluetooth and these other simple devices, I think every fridge you buy 5 years from now will have a Bluetooth device in there. Other appliances. When you charge your electric car, you can easily get a signal for how much the grid value is worth. And so you can equilibrate the grid by saying, okay, I'm okay if my fridge isn't 45 degrees. I'm okay if it goes to 46 or 47. Okay, you enable that. And then when the power cost drops, your fridge comes on, and you multiply that out by millions of homes, and that's a huge amount. The other major issue, which no one talks about, or it's not spoken about in a very prevalent way, is there's all these little fiefdoms of the way the power grids are managed. You know, you have utilities, planning areas, but they're not as highly interconnected, and you don't have as much coordination between these different larger utility scale systems as there could be in order to take full advantage of that and make the whole system much more efficient and more efficiently integrate renewables. Now to your developing world question. So there is solar happening in Africa. South Africa has quite an extensive program. And in South Africa, the lights go off. And one of the reasons, so at Nextracker, I didn't mention that we actually sold our company to Flextronics, which is a $27 billion U.S. company. We did that on October 1 of last year for $330 million. The reason we did that, the reason I supported that merger, was that we had already achieved lead share in developed places like the Americas, Australia, we have the largest tracker. I wanted to take solar into places like India, China, and Brazil that are hard to serve. I've been going to India for 25 years. India, to me, we must get solar right in India specifically, and then sub-Saharan Africa. Why do we need to do that? Because India cannot go the way China went, where they built out all these coal plants. If you go to China, there's no sun because there's coal particulate in the sky. In India, however, the skies are predominantly still clear. So we just finished our first two projects there. So we must build out there. We merged with Flex because they have 8,000 people in India. And so we can use their back office. We're good at my company, Nextracker, like building solar technology, but doing international taxation and trying to get my money out of India, that's not my wheelhouse, okay? But it's theirs. So I think in these developing world places, India, China, and Brazil. Brazil has a huge power crisis right now. You think of Brazil, they have these huge hydro plants, right? Well, there's been a five-year drought in Brazil. They don't have power. A lot of their reservoirs are low. So in this case, again, Flex has 8,000 people in Brazil, so we're serving that market. So these developing markets, I applaud your efforts in Africa. We must go in there. That's the imperative. And solar's worth more in those places. But it's going to be done also on a grid. It's hard to serve those little. And people are doing that with good business models, but it's hard to serve those areas in. I'm a business guy. I don't know how to do a lot of those micro projects, although that is a very valid model where people build out serving, like there'll be some solar panels, a battery, and people can, with their phones, for example, get some power service. So there's a variety of models that are valid, but we're going to see solar in the developing world, and that's where the greatest imperative is, in my opinion. Because then also their socioeconomic condition can improve. And having been in India, a lot of places they can't grow crops because there's a long period with no rain, even though the water's only a few feet under the ground because there's no power to get it out. When you have these solar power, and the Modi government is very motivated to do that, specifically in India, but also I mentioned China. And then I think sub-Saharan Africa will follow. And they'll benefit from the investments that Germany made, 10 years ago, Japan made. They replaced almost all the peak capacity that was lost from the nuclear, from the Fukushima disaster, has been replaced by solar, and that we're making here. And they'll have the benefit of lower costs when they build out. Yes, sir, question.
Thank you for a very invigorating expose of a very exciting industry. A couple of questions that are somewhat related. I think you said that build out right now is a gigawatt a month, or
in the U.S. That's about US, right. Yes.
What percentage of that is tracked systems versus non-tracked systems?
Yes.
And the ancillary question is, you said a tracked system gives you 20 to 30% more output, I think.
Energy over the course of
energy,
a day.
Right. Yes. But how much of that energy has to go back into the systems, the cars, the tracking, the motors, the electronics?
Sure. Great questions. Yes,
those
great questions.
Those are the two.
Great, thank you. Okay, first, just to break down the U.S. market, it's about 50% utility scale, big systems on the ground, 30% residential, and 20% commercial roofs. Okay, so that's just to pie chart, that's where the market is. Now, of the 50% larger systems in utility scale, most of those, say two-thirds approximately, are actually tracking. Those are larger systems on the ground. So that basically would say about 30% of the capacity being installed in the U.S. is actually on a tracker. Now to your question about how much energy it takes to move a tracker, it's virtually zero. And let me break this down for you. Our product at Nextracker, we make a tracker that's 80 to 90 meters long. It's basically as long as a football field. Okay, and that hole, it's got 80 to 90 solar panels on that. And over the course of the day, it goes from 60 degrees east to horizontal at noon and 60 degrees west in the afternoon. We have a motor on that that moves that is 1/10 of a horsepower. It's literally, and when you actually measure it, it's actually only 20 to 30 watts. Your cell phone battery
could power our tracker. And that's possible because it uses these a very high gear ratio to moves, and we have it mechanically balanced, which is part of our patented technology. So we don't even run utility power to it. We run it with a little solar panel, a 30 to 50 watt solar panel that lives on the tracker. So it's self-powered. It uses zero is the answer to that question. Another question. Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, I just have a quick question about sort of centralized utility scale solar and then decentralized. I'm kind of curious, like, what direction you see the U.S. and maybe globally, what direction you see the solar market going.
I'm so glad you asked that question. Thank you for asking that, because I spent the early part of my career as a champion carrying the distributed generation thing. I mentioned, like, this whole methodology we developed for the solar at the end of the grid and then quantifying what it's worth. And we use that methodology to get perfect net metering and all that, okay? But I'm engaged with a lot of huge solar projects now. So let's first talk about ground versus roof, okay? And let me start by saying I'm a huge supporter of both. However, when you put something on a roof, there's just a lot more overhead involved and you have to do a lot more engineering. So at the end of the day, the systems on the ground are about 50% lower cost. And they also make a lot more energy. It's like 30 to 50% more juice, because not only are they tracking, but the system on your roof might not be the exact perfect orientation. There may be shadowing, and it's harder to clean and maintain and things like that. So the systems on the ground, the cost of energy is way less. It doesn't mean rooftop's bad, solar's bad. It's actually very good. It's just there's going to be both, and we're seeing that in the market today. Now, where does the market go? Okay, we're doing a lot of huge systems at Nextracker, but we built a distributed generation unit to serve those. So in my mental model, where it goes is you have a lot of these roof systems, you have a lot of community solar, and this is taking off, especially in the Midwest. There might be instead of a 300 megawatt plant like we built in Carrizo Plains, there might be a 10 or 20 megawatt plant that's serving a local community. And then certain regulatory, there's called virtual net metering that's developing in certain areas where people can get the benefit of that. Maybe they live in like an apartment building or like a high rise, but they want solar. So that can serve, and we can work in partnership with utilities to serve. The beautiful thing about solar is that it's totally modular. So you don't need to do, unlike traditional power plants, which must be done at a huge scale, you can do anything from 1 kilowatt to 100 kilowatts to 1 million kilowatts, and the cost, there's not a very huge penalty. So I think both models will evolve. I personally really like the distributed model where we do these 1 to 20 megawatt plants out in these areas to supplement the roofs, but I still think some big systems in the desert also make sense.
Now for our last question.
Dan, great talk. Thanks very much. Are you concerned with solar success that, you know, net metering is coming under increasing pressure, particularly from the utilities as their business models under pressure? I mean, obviously Nevada being the big one over the last month or two.
Yeah. So one of the big challenges that we have is that there's incumbent industries that are, you know, their business models we spoke about before, what is related to how the tariff structures are set up today. I've personally been fighting that fight since 1989. Okay. So it's not going to go away. It's going to continue. It's going to keep getting more and more intense. But at the end of the day, eventually you're going to be able to just go to Home Depot and buy a super efficient solar panel that has the electronics integrated and just plug it in the wall, right? And literally put it outside and plug it in the wall. There's no stopping that. So you're going to have ongoing fights. We're going to prevail in some. Most, we're going to lose a few on a go forward. But I think the utility industry they're basically the writing's on the wall. They cannot stop this technology trend. It's like if you were manufacturing manual typewriters and you said, well, this computer thing's really bad, we got to kill it. And I'm sorry, you will not be successful in that. So I'll tell you a quick story and that'll be the conclusion of this thing. So I kind of was sitting back thinking, like, I was originally a utility guy. We got to partner with these utilities. What's a win-win model we can do with the utilities on solar? They're really concerned about these solar plants taking revenue and so forth, but they get their money from this authorized rate of return from capital they spend. How can we do this? Okay, what are utilities good at? They're really low risk, and they're really good at raising large amounts of money at very low cost. What does the solar industry need? Well,
all the capital costs is up front. It has super low operating costs. We need low-cost capital. Why don't we do this? So we actually put a plan together to say, let's partner with utilities where we walk in arm in arm to public utilities commissions around the country. And we say, we want the utilities to be able to own more solar, but to be able to work in partnership with the local solar businesses and add those solar projects to their rate base so that they can actually get an authorized rate of return on those. And the solar industry benefits by having a lower cost of capital. This is genius. Like, let's do this, right? Let's do the math. How much are you losing with net metering? You know, one part. How much could you gain with the financing? Well, a couple hundred basis points under what, you know, the commercial finance guys can do. It's a no-brainer. How much is going to be built out in California? You know, another X tens of gigawatts and the rest of the country. So if you look at the cost, you know, it's $50 billion of that stuff, a couple hundred basis points under. Utilities, there's tens of billions of dollars on the table here that we can put in your pocket and everyone wins. So organized a meeting with a very senior executive at a major utility that's involved in regulatory policy and like laid this out like, look, we're going to give this thing to you on a golden platter. We're going to come in arm and go into the Public Utilities Commission. And this gentleman, who's undoubtedly a very smart guy, was like, yeah, we should put together a study group to work on that and figure it out. I was like, okay, we'll do it. I'll join. We'll bring some, you know, really smart people in. Never got a call back on that. So now, having said that, it's going to happen because we're dismantling the fundamental model of the utility system and the way that they're getting revenues back. So there's a great opportunity for progressive utilities to engage and make a ton of money with a new service model. And, you know, if they don't, they're going to go the way Kodak went.
Thank Please you join me in expressing our thanks to Dan Sugar. We would also like to thank our listening audience as well. This is a meeting of the Commonwealth Club. It is now adjourned.